Chapter 1. They trapped the lion on Shamu's plain. They weighted his limbs with an iron chain. They cried aloud in the trumpet blast. They cried, "The lion is caged at last! Woe to the cities of river and plain if ever the lion stalks again." Old Ballad. The roar of battle had died away. The shouts of victory mingled with the cries of the dying. Like gay-hued leaves after an autumn storm, the fallen littered the plain. The sinking sun shimmered on burnished helmets, gilt-worked mail, silver breastplates, broken swords, and the heavy regal folds of silken standards, overthrown in pools of curdling crimson. In silent heaps lay war-horses and their steel-clad riders, flowing manes and blowing plumes stained alike in the red tide. About them and among them, like the drift of a storm, were strewn slashed and trampled bodies in steel caps and leather jerkins, archers and pikemen. The olifants sounded a fanfare of triumph over all the plain, and the hoofs of the victors crunched in the breasts of the vanquished as all the straggling shining lines converged inward, like the spokes of a glittering wheel, to the spot where the last survivor still waged unequal strife. That day Conan, king of Aquilonia, had seen his pick of the chivalry cut to pieces, smashed and hammered to bits and swept into eternity. With 5,000 knights he had crossed the southeastern border of Aquilonia and ridden into the grassy meadowlands of Ophir, to find his former ally, King Amalrus of Ophir, drawn up against him with the hosts of Strabonius, king of Koth. Too late he had seen the trap. All that a man might do he had done with his 5,000 cavalrymen against the 30,000 knights, archers, and spearmen of the conspirators. Without bowmen or infantry, he had hurled his armored horsemen against the oncoming host, had seen the knights of his foes in their shining mail go down before his lances, had torn the opposing center to bits, driving the riven ranks headlong before him, only to find himself caught in a vice as the untouched wings closed in. Strabonius' Shemitish bowmen had wrought havoc among his knights, feathering them with shafts that found every crevice in their armor, shooting down the horses, the Kothian pikemen rushing in to spear the fallen riders. The mailed lancers of the routed center had reformed, reinforced by the riders from the wings, and had charged again and again, sweeping the field by sheer weight of numbers. The Aquilonians had not fled. They had died on the field, and of the 5,000 knights who had followed Conan southward, not one left the field alive. And now the king himself stood at bay among the slashed bodies of his house troops, his back against a heap of dead horses and men. Ophirian knights in gilded mail leaped their horses over mounds of corpses to slash at the solitary figure. Squat Shemites with blue-black beards and dark-faced Kothian knights ringed him on foot. The clangor of steel rose deafeningly. The black-mailed figure of the Western King loomed among his swarming foes, dealing blows like a butcher wielding a great cleaver. Riderless horses raced down the field. About his iron-clad feet grew a ring of mangled corpses. His attackers drew back from his desperate savagery, panting and livid. Now through the yelling, cursing lines rode the lords of the conquerors, Strabonius with his broad, dark face and crafty eyes, Amalrus, slender, fastidious, treacherous, dangerous as a cobra, and the lean figure at Sothalanti, clad only in silken robes, his great black eyes glittering from a face that was like that of a bird of prey. Of this Kothian wizard dark tales were told. Tousle-headed women in northern and western villages frightened children with his name, and rebellious slaves were brought to abashed submission quicker than by the lash, with the threat of being sold to him. Men said that he had a whole library of dark works bound in skin, flayed from living human victims, and that in nameless pits below the hill whereon his palace sat he trafficked with the powers of darkness, trading screaming girl slaves for unholy secrets. He was the real ruler of Koth. Now he grinned bleakly as the kings reined back a safe distance from the grim iron-clad figure looming among the dead. Before the savage blue eyes blazing murderously from beneath the crested, dented helmet, the boldest shrank. Conan's dark, scarred face was darker yet with his passion. His black armor was hacked to tatters and splashed with blood, his great sword red to the crosspiece. In this stress all the veneer of civilization had faded. It was a barbarian who faced his conquerors. Conan was a Cimmerian by birth, one of those fierce, moody hillmen who dwelt in their gloomy, cloudy land in the north. His saga, which had led him to the throne of Aquilonia, was the basis of a whole cycle of hero tales. So now the kings kept their distance, and Strabonius called on his Shemitish archers to loose their arrows at his foe from a distance. His captains had fallen like ripe grain before the Cimmerian's broadsword, and Strabonius, penurious of his knights as of his coins, was frothing with fury. But Sotha shook his head.
"Take him alive."
"Easy to say,"
snarled Strabonius, uneasy lest in some way the black-mailed giant might hew a path to them through the spears.
"Who can take a man-eating tiger alive? By Ishtar, his heel is on the necks of my finest swordsmen. It took 7 years and stacks of gold to train each, and there they lie, so much kites' meat. Arrows, I say."
"Again, nay,"
snapped Sotha, swinging down from his horse. He laughed coldly.
"Have you not learned by this time that my brain is mightier than any sword?"
He passed through the lines of the pikemen, and the giants in their steel caps and male brigandines shrank back fearfully, lest they so much as touch the skirts of his robe. Nor were the plumed knights slower in making room for him. He stepped over the corpses and came face to face with the grim king. The hosts watched in tense silence, holding their breath. The black-armored figure loomed in terrible menace over the lean, silk-robed shape, the notched, dripping sword hovering on high.
"I offer you life, Conan,"
said Sotha, a cruel mirth bubbling at the back of his voice.
"I give you death, wizard,"
snarled the king, and backed by iron muscles and ferocious hate, the great sword swung in a stroke meant to shear Tsotha's lean torso in half. But even as the hosts cried out, the wizard stepped in, too quick for the eye to follow, and apparently merely laid an open hand on Conan's left forearm, from the ridged muscles of which the mail had been hacked away. The whistling blade veered from its arc, and the mailed giant crashed heavily to earth to lie motionless. Sotha laughed silently.
"Take him up and fear not. The lion's fangs are drawn."
The kings reined in and gazed in awe at the fallen lion. Conan lay stiffly, like a dead man, but his eyes glared up at them, wide open and blazing with helpless fury.
"What have you done to him?"
asked Amalrus uneasily. Sotha displayed a broad ring of curious design on his finger. He pressed his fingers together, and on the inner side of the ring, a tiny steel fang darted out like a snake's tongue.
"It is steeped in the juice of the purple lotus which grows in the ghost-haunted swamps of southern Stygia," said the magician. "Its touch produces temporary paralysis. Put him in chains and lay him in a chariot. The sun sets, and it is time we were on the road for Korshamish."
Strabonius turned to his general, Urbanus.
"We return to Korshamish with the wounded. Only a troop of the royal cavalry will accompany us. Your orders are to march at dawn to the Aquilonian border and invest the city of Shamar. The Ophirians will supply you with food along the march. We will rejoin you as soon as possible with reinforcements."
So the host, with its steel-sheathed knights, its pikemen and archers and camp servants, went into camp in the meadowlands near the battlefield. And through the starry night, the two kings and the sorcerer who was greater than any king rode to the capital of Strabonus in the midst of the glittering palace troop, and accompanied by a long line of chariots loaded with the wounded. In one of these chariots lay Conan, king of Aquilonia, weighted with chains, the tang of defeat in his mouth, the blind fury of a trapped tiger in his soul. The poison which had frozen his mighty limbs to helplessness had not paralyzed his brain. As the chariot in which he lay rumbled over the meadowlands, his mind revolved maddeningly about his defeat. Amalrus had sent an emissary imploring aid against Strabonus, who he said was ravaging his western domain, which lay like a tapering wedge between the border of Aquilonia and the vast southern kingdom of Koth. He asked only 1,000 horsemen and the presence of Conan to hearten his demoralized subjects. Conan now mentally blasphemed. In his generosity, he had come up with 5 times the number the treacherous monarch had asked. In good faith, he had ridden into Ophir, and he had been confronted by the supposed rivals allied against him. It spoke significantly of his prowess that they had brought up a whole host to trap him and his 5,000. A red cloud veiled his vision. His veins swelled with fury, and in his temples a pulse throbbed maddeningly. In all his life, he had never known greater and more helpless wrath. In swift-moving scenes, the pageant of his life passed fleetingly before his mental eye. a panorama wherein moved shadowy figures which were himself in many guises and conditions, a skin-clad barbarian, a mercenary swordsman in horned helmet and scale-mail corselet, a corsair in a dragon-proud galley that trailed a crimson wake of blood and pillage along southern coasts, a captain of hosts in burnished steel on a rearing black charger, a king on a golden throne with the lion banner flowing above and throngs of gay-hued courtiers and ladies on their knees. But always the jouncing and rumbling of the chariot brought his thoughts back to revolve with maddening monotony about the treachery of Amalrus and the sorcery of Tsotha. The veins nearly burst in his temples, and cries of the wounded in the chariots filled him with ferocious satisfaction. Before midnight they crossed the Ophirian border, and at dawn the spires of Korshemish stood up gleaming and rose-tinted on the southeastern horizon, the slim towers overawed by the grim scarlet citadel that at a distance was like a splash of bright blood in the sky. That was the castle of Tsotha. Only one narrow street, paved with marble and guarded by heavy iron gates, led up to it, where it crowned the hill dominating the city. The sides of that hill were too sheer to be climbed elsewhere. From the walls of the citadel one could look down on the broad white streets of the city, on minareted mosques, shops, temples, mansions, and markets. One could look down, too, on the palaces of the king, set in broad gardens, high-walled, luxurious riots of fruit trees and blossoms through which artificial streams murmured and silvery fountains rippled incessantly. Over all brooded the citadel, like a condor stooping above its prey, intent on its own dark meditations. The mighty gates between the huge towers of the outer wall clanged open, and the king rode into his capital between lines of glittering spearmen, while 50 trumpets pealed salute. But no throngs swarmed the white-paved streets to fling roses before the conqueror's hoofs. Strabonus had raced ahead of news of the battle, and the people, just rousing to their occupations of the day, gaped to see their king returning with a small retinue, and were in doubt as to whether it portended victory or defeat. Conan, life sluggishly moving in his veins again, craned his neck from the chariot floor to view the wonders of this city, which men called the Queen of the South. He had thought to ride some day through these golden-chased gates at the head of his steel-clad squadrons with the great lion banner flowing over his helmeted head. Instead, he entered in chains, stripped of his armor, and thrown like a captive slave on the bronze floor of his conqueror's chariot. A wayward devilish mirth of mockery rose above his fury, but to the nervous soldiers who drove his chariot, his laughter sounded like the muttering of a rousing lion.